This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. Donald Trump's Muslim ban has a sordid historical precedent. Those old enough to remember can recall the horrific chapter in American history when more than 100,000 Japanese Americans were rounded up and incarcerated in camps as the fear over World War II gripped the nation in 1942. Reminding us of this grim history in crystal clear images are works by some of the most preeminent photographers of the past century. Dorothea Lange, Ansel Adams, and others were hired, surprisingly, by the U.S. government itself to document this ugly policy as it was being implemented. Now, these powerful images are collected in a timely new book called Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. My guest Richard Kahan now joins me. He is the author of 12 books, including an acclaimed history of the federal court in Chicago, a court that shaped America. He served as a picture editor of the Chicago Sun-Times, and he's currently an independent scholar at the Newberry Library in Chicago. And together with Michael Williams, he has written and curated the images in the book Un-American. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
Let's first jump into a little bit of history before we actually talk about the images themselves and the book. I mentioned in my introduction that it was Japanese Americans, more than, you know, about 100,000 of them. But exactly which folks are we talking about? I understand it was a combination of first generation and second generation Japanese.
Right. The incarceration of Japanese Americans really began on Pearl Harbor Day, December 7th, 1941, when America bombed Pearl Harbor and over 2,000 Americans were killed. 11 weeks later, February 20th, exactly 75 years ago, President Roosevelt issued an executive order saying that the military should decide the fate of Japanese Americans who were living on the West Coast. So this included about 110,000, or actually a little over 110,000 Japanese Americans, both first generation Japanese Americans who had come starting in the late 19th century and who had no chance at citizenship. It was illegal for them to become citizens, and their children, about 70,000 of them, and they were all U.S. citizens because they were born in the United States.
So you choose to use the word incarceration rather than internment. Why? Because today we usually hear it is referred to as a Japanese internment.
Right. Internment is the word that's really been used for most of these 75 years. And I chose incarceration because internment is really an inaccurate term. To be interned, you can't intern a U.S. citizen. And as I just mentioned, about 70,000 of these people were U.S. citizens. So it's a lie. It's just inaccurate. We wanted to use the term internment because we live in an age of keywords, and that's the keyword that people relate to. But several people I talked to, several survivors of the camp, said, why do you start your book with a lie? You should use the word incarceration. They basically convinced me. I thought it was, one thing that I've learned through this book was that the use of language is really determined by the victors, by people in control, and I felt that internment was the wrong word. So we talk about it in the book, but then we don't use it.
Right. And of course, today there's a battle over language where Donald Trump doesn't want us to use the term Muslim ban. Okay, so obviously the relevance of this to what's happening today is huge. What is remarkable, however, is that the U.S. government, and I didn't realize this, that the U.S. government hired photographers to document their hideous policy. I suppose the government officials didn't think of what they were doing as something horribly violent and an affront to ethics and norms of human rights. How is it that they hired, or why did they hire photographers like Dorothea Lange? I mean, really preeminent photographers.
Right. It was the custom of the government in those days to document their work. Dorothea Lange had started her work in the 1930s with the government's Farm Security Administration, which was helping Midwesterners relocate to California. And I think it was very important for the government to document the work so that Americans knew what was going on and also that the Japanese government knew what was going on. The Japanese government held many U.S. citizens, and the photos were meant to make a case that these people were treated humanely. It certainly was humane in the sense of there were very few people that were injured or killed during this, but I would very much question whether it was humane treatment to take an American citizen, not charge him, hold them for three and a half years for the duration, not tell them where they were being taken to, and basically taking them to the far reaches of America, into camps, mostly in the West, in the deserts of the West.
So tell us about the photographs that you curated and put together in this incredible book, Un-American. How did you have access to these photos? How did you choose them? It seems as though there's essentially a chronological order to kind of trace the journey of what happened to many of these Japanese Americans.
Well, these photos actually belong to all of us. They're at the National Archives. They were taken by government photographers, so they really, we paid for them, and we as Americans own them. We did go to the National Archives, and we spent about a week there looking through, 20 boxes of photographs. There were about 7,000 of them. And we made a decision on picking photographs that we thought were the most artistic and the most historically important, that really show what it was like, what life was like to undergo this. The government chose the wrong photographer to promote their efforts. Dorothea Lange, as listeners will probably know, was an incredibly direct, empathetic photographer. The government knew right away that she wasn't going to promote the government's efforts and that she didn't see any humanity involved in it. She ended up working 3 months on the project. She was hassled from the beginning and found it to be one of the most difficult parts of her photographic career. She was actually replaced by another photographer by the name of Francis Stewart. He, like Dorothea Lange, died several years ago, but I did get a chance to talk to Francis Stewart's son, and he confirmed that it was this very similar situation with Mr. Stewart. He was disheartened by the effort. He lasted, less than a year on the project. And after that, they hired more conventional government working photographers to show what life was like in the camp through those last 3 years.
What's remarkable to me in looking through these incredible photos is, I mean, not just, of course, the quality of them, they're absolutely stunning, right, but also the subjects. The photographers, I think, showcased very beautifully the dignity of Japanese Americans and what they were going through. Their shoulders are straight. They're looking straight into the camera. They are defiant in many ways. Even the photos of children, did you find that as well?
Oh, absolutely. And we included the work of Ansel Adams in this book. And he's got a little asterisk after his name when it comes to working as a government photographer, because he wasn't hired by the government or paid by the government, but he was authorized by the director of one of the camps, Manzanar, in Central California, to come, and he spent on and off up to a year in this camp. And his pictures, I think, are particularly show the strength and the dignity of Japanese Americans who were in this camp. He donated his pictures after the war to the Library of Congress. So those pictures, too, are available to all of us, because work in the Library of Congress is available. It's in the public domain. We used his work. People know him as the great landscape photographer of the West, but interestingly, he always felt that this was the most important work he did in his career.
Wow. So let's talk about the images that show Japanese Americans being basically pulled out of their homes, you know, armed guards standing in front of San Francisco homes, and then put on trains. They're just basically on trains, and you see these soldiers, American soldiers, just watching over them. There is a violence in these photos, although, of course, as you said, no one's being beaten up, right?
Right, right. I think what's really unusual about this collection is that it starts so early. Dorothea Lange officially started in April of 1942. But even before she started photographing what life was like in Japanese communities. And I think it's surprising when you look at the photographs. Many people in these communities live very traditional middle-class lives. You see pictures of mansions, and you see pictures of farms, and you see pictures of the way they dressed, blue jeans and leather belts. And this was not an insular, this is not the stereotypical Japanese Americans that that we see in our minds at the start of World War II. They were striving to get ahead and to live middle class lives, and their lives were interrupted so quickly. And then we see photographs of their preparations. They were generally given about a week to sell whatever they owned, farms, tractors, homes. Obviously, the sales were at basic, they almost gave things away because they were only given a week to take what they could carry, was what they were told. And a week later, they were told to report. There are many pictures of them reporting, being put on buses, like you mentioned, taken to camps. And I think that they were shocked when they got to these temporary camps. They were shocked by the barbed wire that surrounded the camps, by the soldiers who were standing with machine guns, that rifles and bayonets pointed at them. And this was the beginning of a three-year tragedy. Many of them stayed the duration of the war until really late 1945.
Richard, there's a section in your book, there's one photograph that jumps out at me, and I'd like you to explain the context of it. It's just a photograph of stairs at the Burlington Hotel in Los Angeles, and there's some signs on the stairs. For our radio audience, I'll read them out. The first step has a sign saying "New Management, White Americans." The second step says "Free Room Rent the Third Week," and then the next step says "Room Close in Clean, Modern, etc." So details of what you would expect at a hotel, but it's that first sign: "New Management, White Americans." What is the story behind this photo?
Yeah, this is a hotel in Japantown in Los Angeles, and it shows how quickly things happened. Within weeks, hotels were sold or given away, sold for next to nothing, and Japanese neighborhoods were taken over by new California immigrants and by new businessmen, and the communities were disappeared within weeks and months. And by the time the war ended, the Japanese Americans returned to their communities, they saw a completely different place. That's it's a particularly sad, brutal photograph because you see these legs walking up the stairs with these signs, and it just shows you how fast everything changed.
So basically, people lost or were forced to divest of the assets that they had worked for, earned, over maybe years or a generation, and because they were just given a week to pack up and be forced into these camps, they, as you said, just, you know, and often had to practically give away homes and businesses. So this was right. Even more than a stripping of their dignity and an incarceration of their lives. This was almost a theft.
It absolutely was, and it really shows what happens when security and panic absolutely triumphs over civil liberties and civil rights. There were no trials held. There was actually one trial held by Fred Korematsu, but basically nobody had a chance to stand up, protest, and this all happened within, the entire 110,000 of Japanese Americans were taken within 6 months from Washington to Arizona and everything in between. So Western Oregon, Western Washington, all of California, and a little strip of Arizona.
Let's talk about the quarters in which they were held. And you have photographs in this book, Un-American, that show these as well, and really, I think, helpfully document them. I mean, basically, these were hastily built temporary housing-type facilities?
Right. The temporary facilities, and there were 18 of them, were basically in horse tracks and in county fairgrounds. The government was just looking for facilities that they could take over and house Japanese Americans in a temporary manner, oftentimes anywhere from 2 months to about 6 months. What's remembered by so many people is that many Japanese Americans were literally forced to sleep in horse stalls. A week before they were taken there, there were actual racehorses in these stalls. They were removed. The stalls were painted white, but they were clean, but obviously they were uninhabitable. The majority of people were sent to very cheaply constructed army barrack type facilities. And these barracks were not made for any kind of permanent solution. It was just a very temporary solution. From there, things actually got worse. They were put on trains. They were taken out to Indian reservations in Arizona, deserts in California, forests in Arkansas. There were 10 permanent camps for these four Japanese Americans, and life was very difficult. There's so many accounts of a lack of privacy. Whole families and sometimes neighbors were all forced into single facilities. Bathrooms were inadequate and not private. There were mess halls instead of, you know, dining rooms. So within weeks, life had changed drastically.
They were imprisoned. I mean, that's basically what it was. They were imprisoned.
They absolutely were prisoners. They were surrounded by barbed wire, and there were soldiers guarding them.
So what sort of, within the camps themselves, presumably photographers like Dorothea Lange were allowed to walk through and document them. What sorts of things did the photographers document these imprisoned Japanese Americans doing? There's pictures of them farming, etc. Can you describe some of those day-to-day activities that were documented?
Right. There are many remarkable stories that came out of this, and one of them is the fact that how Japanese Americans adjusted. They did create their own communities. I don't want that to sound like these were real communities. They were totally artificial, and they were totally impressed to make these. But they did create schools were created by the government. The teachers were either Japanese Americans or Caucasians who were brought into the schools. There was farming. There was even adult education. There was sports for children. But I don't, you know, sometimes I even worry about the word camp, because camp has this connotation that it was something that was fun, that it was a recreation, that it was an activity. Nothing could be farther than the truth. They were paid pittance for their work. They were, forced to live in conditions that were completely different than what they were used to. And they weren't told how long they would be incarcerated. They weren't told where they would be taken. They lost all contact with their friends and family after they left the temporary camps, and life was brutal.
So finally, let's talk about how, after 3 years, when the program finally ended, and you could, you know, have a whole book about how that happened and the activism around that. But let's focus on the documenting that the photographers did of this community of people, these almost 110,000 Japanese Americans. How were they freed? What were they given? Were they compensated?
Well, they were freed because their cases finally matriculated to the Supreme Court. And on the day that the Supreme Court was going to decide that this was unconstitutional, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in late December 1944, opened up the camps as of, I think, January 1st or 2nd of 1945. It took about 7 months for people to be able to leave the camps and find a home. Again, everything happened very quickly. They returned. A large percentage returned to California, and a large percentage decided that California and the West Coast was not where they wanted to do, and they started different lives. Finally, law and reason prevailed, but it took many, many years. And I think that's something that we have to realize now is a fact of life. There's now talks, when talking about bans of Muslims and Muslim countries, there's talk of the constitutionality of it all. It's very unlikely. And interestingly, people are using the word un-American, which is the title of the book, very frequently, I've noticed, in describing what's going on, that's gone on the last week.
I mean, just let's end our conversation with this relevance to today. In the years after these camps, these prison camps were ended, we heard a lot of people say things like, never again. You know, we would never let this happen in American society again. But today, here we are under the rule of a madman who seems to think he can do whatever he wants and who has obviously very little idea of history. I mean, he doesn't even know who Frederick Douglass is. He probably has no clue of what happened in the 1940s to Japanese Americans. how do we remind ourselves that what was wrong in 1942 is just as wrong today? And I should mention a lot of prominent Japanese Americans are speaking out today and warning of the dangers.
Right. I think it's important for people to realize that this is an ancient history. This happened 75 years ago. Many of the people who were photographed by Dorothea Lange and the other government photographers are still alive. We had a chance to track them down, find them, and interview them. And they all told us about their experiences, and they told us about their concerns about America today. I think it's important for people to look at books like this. There's a real value to photography. It transports us back to these days, and we can understand that the road that America took was not the right road. I think that the pictures and the book is heartbreaking. And I think it's important for people to understand, and I think they do. This is something that we didn't expect. I think they very much understand how relevant the book is today.
Well, Richard, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and for the work that you've done in putting this book together. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And for our TV audience, if you'd like to see the photographs that we've been discussing, you can watch this TV version on our website if you miss it at risingupwithsonali.com. I've been speaking with Richard Cahan. He is the co-author, along with Michael Williams, of the book Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/RU with Sonali.